Okay, it's 8:31, so I'm
Okay.
going to begin.
Okay.
Hello, everyone. Let me give you the date here. It's the 21st of November, 2022. Continuing right where we left off, for those who are interested, I also had a blog post, the first one I've had in many months. You can check out this forum blog. Deals with this enigmatic figure named Rosenberg, stuff there about Mordechai Kaplan, about Yeshiva College, Israel Elfenbein. What else do I have there? A bunch of other things. So you can check that out. Last class, I couldn't remember the name of the book that I had in mind. Here it is, from the Orthodox Forum, Jewish Tradition and the Non-Traditional Jew. There you have the article by Kanner Fogel, and you can read all about how, in medieval Ashkenaz, we see that people weren't stopped wearing tefillin first for the entire day, and then later we see outright neglect that they weren't worn at all. He talks about mezuzahs. Rabbeinu Tam says less than 10 years have passed and there's no mezuzahs here. The idea that a lack of observance is only a modern thing, we see very clearly it's not. One of our listeners said that I made a mistake in a pronunciation, and I'm always trying to be very careful about that, and that in referring to Rameir Don Plotsky, the great, we call him in yeshiva circles, you just call him Rameir Don. He actually came to America. He spoke at Yeshiva Sirvitz Elchanan in the 20s. I mentioned his sefer, Klei Chemda. So he pointed out that it's actually Klei Chemda. Well, I actually looked online and lots of people say Klei Chemda, including Rabbi Bleich, but that's irrelevant because lots of people can make a mistake. But I looked in the concordance. Two times the word is Klei Chemda, and one time it's Klei Chemda. Actually, this is interesting for another reason, I think, because in Divrei Hayamim, chapter 2, Lamed Beis, Perek Lamed Beis, if you look in Chav Zayin, there we see it says, L'chol Klei Chemda, which means all manners of goodly vessels. But if you look in Nachum, chapter 2, verse 10, it also says, Mikol Klei Chemda. And the translation is the same, all precious vessels. And that's what it means. We have, and the same thing in Hosea. So here we have an example where the word Klei, although really Klei is one vessel and Klei is more than one, it really means the same thing. And therefore, if this was in the Torah, I think that if you read Klei instead of Klei, you would not have to repeat. When I say not have to repeat, I mean, we assume you repeat if you make a mistake. Tosfos says you don't make people repeat. And there's concerns people, I think even Tosfos might, the concern might be because of embarrassing people. Rav Nachum Rabinovich held halacha l'maisa that a bar mitzvah boy, you don't correct him because there's these views that we don't need to correct. But the way we hold is that we do correct, but if it doesn't change the meaning of the word, believe it or not, even the word aharon, if you say hey resh nun, aharon without the aleph, they say that's good enough. So I think it should be clear, I think, that if you would have said kli instead of clay, since it really kli chemda means the same thing, I don't think you would repeat. But you can ask, it's irrelevant because it doesn't the word doesn't appear in the Torah. Let's see. Next thing I wanted to point out to you, I listened to the tape and I saw it wasn't very clear in this business about washing. If you have wet food, I said you have wet food, you eat it. The halacha is if you have food, take an apple and you wash it and it's wet, you have to wash. That's what we ignore. And all the poskim for hundreds of years want to know why, other than Pesach, where we do wash, we all know we get up early on the carpets. We get up and we wash. Why we don't wash for other foods? Nachum sends me Nachum Shmaryahu. He says I'm incorrect. I said last class that Chabad does one yom one doesn't do Yom Tov Sheni if you go there, and he points out it's actually a machlokas in Chabad. So I thank you, Nachum Shmariyahu. In fact, I looked online. If you go to Chabadipedia, there's Wikipedia and there's Chabadipedia. They have an article on Yom Tov Sheni Shagalios, and they say that the problem is that there's a stira, the Rebbe. The Rebbe in one place writes that when you go to Israel, you do like they in Israel. And another place, he says that no, you should do a chutzaret. So there's all different ways to understand this. Some say it means they distinguish between if you go with your wife or if you go by yourself. But Amaisa, there's different opinions, and there's no one, contrary to what I heard this from a Chabad guy, so he was only giving me one Chabad approach. But Chabad does not have only one way of doing things. Okay, we have a few more minutes. I mentioned last class this book, Jacob Katz's autobiography. And I was basically, my memory was correct. If you look on page 82, and he's a musmach in Frankfurt, from Jew, no question about it. But he writes about, I was a little wrong. I mean, I didn't remember exactly the story. The story is as follows. In Frankfurt, he said that the question was raised among us, namely among the Orthodox young academic types, why a Jewish historiography in the spirit of Orthodox Judaism has never been written. And he says that he replied as follows, quote, "There is no Orthodox historiography because there is no Orthodox history." That is, that the way the Orthodox tell you things happened really isn't how it happened. And then he says the very next page that he says the trend of my thinking matched well the school of historiography of Frankl. And he also mentions the Salman Schechter as well. But so he says that although in religiosity, you'd have to regard him as Orthodox. But when it comes to the way his historical thinking, as I mentioned, we spoke about how to understand halachic history, he views himself as part of, in the Frankl school. Okay, got a couple of minutes. We have a listener from Israel. I only know this because his comments are in Hebrew. He left it on I think two times ago or maybe three, the class on YouTube. I don't look for the listeners. I don't look back at the classes and respond to comments on YouTube. But for the first couple of classes, I look just to see if anyone comments. And I say to you that you cited something very interesting, but you didn't give the source. So I'll give the source. What he cites is that Lieberman, Shaul Lieberman at Yosef Givshuta, also mentions a couple other people who refer positively to Zacharia Frankl. And one of them he mentions is the one of them that Lieberman mentions is the Ephraim Nine. If you look in the back of the Bavli, you have I guess you call it a commentary, which contrasts the Rishalmi to the Bavli. And if you look in Bava Basra, well, first of all, it's in Tosefta Kivshuta, Bava Basra, page 335. He calls attention to the fact that the Yafei Naim cites Rav Zacharia Frankl. And then he mentions, this is Lieberman, mentions this book. It's by Rav Gershon Meir, by Ruski. And it's called, here's the title page. You can see it on HebrewBooks.org. Bava Kama of the Yerushalmi, with the commentary Yerushalmi Atzrufa. Now, this is an interesting volume because it has a haskama from Rav Chaim Brisker, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, and who's very positive about this rabbi. There aren't many svarim that have haskamas from Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. And if you look on the very first page of this volume, in the second column, right where my cursor is, what is this Rav site? Ayin Mavoha Yerushalmi Rav Zacharia Frankl. So you see this big Talmud Chacham who wrote a Sefer in Yerushalmi also cites Frankl. Maybe he didn't know everything we're going to talk about today because there are some issues. Okay, so two more things I want to share with you. And then in the very first class, I mentioned about the Frumkeit of Frankl. And I told this story about the Erev, Frankl being more mocked than the other rabbis. And I said, I thought I saw it in Schwab, and I didn't find it there. Lo and behold, I found it. And the story is almost how I remembered it. If you look in the periodical Hamayan, and if you look in my Sorenbach post, I discuss this word Mayan. The biblical way of saying it is Mayan, Shva under the eye, not Ma'ayan. And I point out, as I pointed out in my classes, that the popular girls' school in Teaneck, which calls itself Ma'ayanot, gets it wrong. That's the proper word is Mayanot, not Ma'ayanot. But on the bright side, pretty much everyone, I live in that area, we know people go there, everyone pronounces it correctly. When they write it, it's incorrect. But when they're speaking, everyone says Ma'ayanot. I've never in my life heard anyone say, my kid goes to Ma'ayanot. It's all Ma'ayanot. So that's correct. But so in the Torah Journal Hamayan, volume 26, issue 4, an article by Abraham Shisha, he reports the following, which I think is really interesting, that he says, first of all, Frankel was completely observant, but he says, I heard this from Rav Yeshaya first. He was the rabbi of the Schiff Shul. In Vienna, you had a shul, a separatist Orthodox shul called the Schiff Shul. It was founded by the Chasam Sofer's sons-in-law. It existed till World War II. And he told the following story that, and he heard this from Rabbi Yeshaya first in Letchworth. That's during the war. Rabbi Yeshaya first was able to escape from Vienna and make his way to England. That Frankel once came for a holiday to the city, to Baden next to Wien, or whatever, I guess that's a city there. It doesn't just mean the baths, or maybe, because he calls it Baden by Wien. And this is where a lot of the rabbis from Hungary and Galicia would go and take the cure, as they used to go. Take in the, like the people go to Syracuse, so it knows. What do they call it? Not Syracuse, Saratoga Springs. So the Skver Rebbe every year before COVID would go back to Hungary to take the springs, take the cure at the springs. And when the Torah Motion trip was there once, he was there in Bratislava. So it says that, here's the story. Frankel had a room in the hotel, the Jewish hotel, where many other Gedolim were there. And he says that all the other Gedolim would take their talis bag, their items on Shabbos. They bring it to the Chadar Ochel and bring it to where they daven. Frankel, alone among them, was medakdek shelo lahotzi klum. He held, I guess, he held that, you know, there was no, they didn't make an Erev Chatzeros. I think we assume that you don't need to, but he held that you needed an Erev Chatzeros, and therefore he didn't take anything out of his room. Now, first writes, or first said, the rabbis of Galicia were very impressed by this Rav Moderni, this modern rabbi who was so makpid. Lo ken rabbanei Hagar, not so the Hungarian rabbis who knew about Lieberman's ideas. So, and we will see some of his ideas now. For next class, I will I'll share with you a couple other things about Frankel, and also from about the rabbinical seminary in Breslau from Bernard Drachman's memoir. But I see it's already time, so let me put this down. And one more thing I have to tell you, though, although he was very, very from, if you look in Hamayan, volume 26, issue 2, page, well, I don't know what page, the article by Dr. David Hausdorff, where he's dealing with Rabbi Ritter, the Agudist rabbi of Rotterdam, who was very he was very much an admirer of Zachariah Frankel. In this article, you see that Frankel used to carry an umbrella on Shabbos. So he's not so maybe machmir on that, but the Chasam Sofer held you can carry an umbrella on Shabbos. That was the practice in a number of places. Even in Eretz Yisrael, in the past, I brought a tshuva sefer that says you can. So I'm not going to, today, if you do that, you'd be in trouble. But I don't know that. You know, I'm going to go to Florida, God willing, in a couple of days. And in Florida, I mentioned this. I'll mention it again because we have new people. You see something you don't see up here. Scooters. Not the electric scooters, those scooters, just the regular scooters kids drive. People are using them to come to shul every Shabbos in the hot weather. You could live, let's see, 15, 20 minutes away, use a scooter. Everyone does it. Now, I heard from my friend that in one of the big modern Orthodox shuls, the rabbi wanted to stop it because he didn't think it's in Shabbos spirit. But the problem is all the Haredim. They're all, and at the shul I go to in Florida is full of Haredi quasi Haredi. The point is everyone's using it, and I have yet to see anyone in my neck of the woods use it. And I think if you did, they'd look at you strange, but in Florida, everyone's doing it. So as goes Florida, so goes the nation. I assume we're going to start seeing, if not this coming summer, next summer, you'll start seeing people with the scooters. There really isn't. It's no different than a tricycle. No one said a tricycle is a problem. The bicycle is an issue because of the gears or maybe the wheels, you know, the chain. But the scooter, it's just there's nothing to break, really. So I can see why it would become popular. And if the Haredi rabbis are saying it's no problem down in Florida, it's a little bit strange for the modern Orthodox rabbis to be saying it's a problem. Modern Orthodox to be more machmir than the Haredi, but usually that's matters, monetary matters, you know, dina de machusa dina, that sort of thing. But when it comes to Shabbos, you know, I think we can assume that that the modern Orthodox are not going to be any more machmir, I think. Anyone, well, Gershon, who says he sees people riding the bicycles to shul, if the Syrians want to do it, they can. The Ben Ishchai said so. There's a practice in the Syrian community, but Ashkenazim have never accepted it. And unless you're riding one of these bikes without a chain or something, really, there's no permission, in my opinion, for an Ashkenazi to ride a bicycle on Shabbos, unless a big posek said you could. But I can tell you that no big posek has said you could. And even among the Syrians, it's becoming less and less popular to ride it. Okay. The last thing we said last class is I gave many examples of like halachic, where the people do something and that sort of changes the halacha because the rabbis, we're talking about pious communities, Kiel Kadosha, the rabbis are forced to find some justification for it in many cases. And I describe that as sort of in line with how Frankel describes how Jewish law operates. I quoted Chaim Soloveitchik, I quoted academic scholars, but also traditional Torah scholars. And I ended with quoting the Rashtam, Shmuel Din Medina, one of the greatest poskim in the early Achronic period, that we have to, if the entire world, in rabbinic literature, they call it the Olam. If the Olam is, and the Olam means the religious Jews, it's not the non-religious. But if the Olam is doing something, if the Olam is riding bicycles, not bicycles, scooters on Shabbos, then you have to assume that there's some justification or you should try to find one. That's what the Rashtam says. You should exert yourself to find some justification for it. And that's where we ended off. We also spoke about this notion that the rabbi, if we had a Sanhedrin, that we could, if the people, according to the Rambam, at least that's what the Chesed Mishnah reads, that if the people accepted a gezeirah, a decree, a rabbinic law, let's say, and then they stopped doing it, then the rabbis could get rid of it. You know, we're not going to say that you need to be greater or greater based in. The rabbis can get rid of it, but you would need a Sanhedrin. Unlike the case where the people never adopted the practice. I want to show you one thing which is related to this, which I think is interesting. Show you this isn't just theoretical. Where is it? The Rav Chaim Hirschenson, who was, I found this years ago. It's from a periodical called Hamitzpah. It's a periodical that appeared in the early 20th century in America, a Torah periodical. One of the first ones, I found it and I made a copy of it and then I sent it to Otzar HaChachma and to HebrewBooks.org. So when you look on those sources, that's the one I sent them. But in the very first issue, you have an anonymous letter, which was later revealed to be by Rav Chaim Hirschenson because it created a big controversy. And I will discuss this if I ever get to do my book on Halachic History of America, but Rabbi Hirschenson is struggling with the fact that you have among the American Jewish community ostensibly religious Jews, but they violate various things. So he has a theory, we did classes on him, so you can listen, but he has a whole approach that we don't want the people to be seen or to see themselves as sinners, because if they see themselves as sinners, they're going to just sin more. So he wants to try to find heterim, if you can, to try to justify, even if it means bending over backwards, so that the people do not see themselves as sinners. So he puts forth, I think it's 24 questions of the time, and he wants to know whether we rabbis can find a solution. And the first one is, Im yicholim anu hayom, if we, the rabbis today, can linso heter is isur derabanan, if we can find a heter for an isur derabanan that the people are violating, al pi akal de gzera shon ispashta berov hatzibur yichol matira ayde based in katan. Based upon the principle, we've seen that if the people are not following it, that even a lesser based in could get rid of it. Now, he must be referring to with the Sanhedrin, because the Rambam is clear that you need a Sanhedrin. It doesn't have to be a Beis Din HaGadol. It doesn't have to be as great as the earlier Beis Din, but you would need a Sanhedrin. But that would mean, for instance, that any rabbinic prohibition, and in the early 20th century in America, there's a lot of these rabbinic prohibitions that weren't being observed by the people that in theory you can get rid of. And he goes on and he raises other issues, which... But just to quickly show you some of them. Number two deals with heating food up on Shabbos. Five, gavina, cheese made by non-Jews, but it's all vegetable. The accepted view is that we don't eat that, although there is a position in Tosfot that it's permissible. And Rav Soloveitchik actually held it was. He asks about that. Number six is an interesting one. What about those people who are machal Shabbos before Hesia? How are we to regard them? He divides it into, are they violating rabbinic prohibitions, Torah prohibitions? Are they violating it because they don't care or they don't know any better? Number eight, what about milking cows? You have Jews on Shabbos and Yom Tov. There's no non-Jews. We have people who lived, you had Jewish farmers. And number nine, selling chametz, even if they sell their chametz, but they're still in the store, still using the... That is, they sell their chametz, but they're still selling it to non-Jews. They don't even own it, technically. What do we do about that? Then 28. Okay, 28 different issues he wants to deal with. Now, as I said, both Hershenson and Frankel assume that you have to deal with Kila Kadosha. All these things we're speaking about. I think one of the ones he mentions there is shaving with a razor. I believe he, number four. Piluch Zakan, Asher Tzeire America Kimat Anusim Bazeh. He says, what about shaving with a razor? He says that in America, everyone has to shave. And they're not going to use that powder stuff, which no one liked. Can you find a heter for that? He actually found a heter. He has a responsum in which he claims that... The only razor that's forbidden is like the long razors that would, you'd go like this, the long ones, but the Bic type ones that we have, that would not be forbidden. And he describes it, how to do it, but okay, that's basically not accepted. Before we go on, I want to say one more thing. And that's, I've had some private email and correspondence with people because last class I mentioned that the Chasam Sofer says that even a rabbinic prohibition for emergency measure, if the rabbis want to, post-Talmudic rabbis, they could suspend it. So where do you draw the line? You know, how much can the rabbis do? I used to think, by the way, that a lot of the things that we talk about that you suspend prohibitions temporarily, that this is only for the rabbis, the Sanhedrin, or suspend obligatory things only for Sanhedrin, or at the very least members of Chazal. Now I'm not convinced of that. I think recognize Gedolei Yisrael. I have enough sources that show that recognize Gedolei Yisrael could also do this, but they have to be at the level, I guess, of the Chasam Sofer. So. But I, you know, this is a topic I don't want to really get into that much because it's really relevant to the Reform. But from both Frankel and the Orthodox, they're really not moving in that direction of changing halacha at all. But since I was asked, I just want to show one source, and it really needs to be investigated. This is a source that's cited by many people. Robert Gordas, I recall him citing it. Anyone who believes that Jewish law needs to move, maybe Berkovitz cites it, they cite this source. And I don't know how far you could take it. Like I said, I think that the contemporary rabbis, if they're of a certain stature, do have this authority. I used to think not. I used to think it was only rabbinic. from the rabbinic period, Amoraim or Tanaim. But let me show you what I'm talking about. And it raises the question, what's the definition then of a reform? What can a rabbi do? In Masachet in Yeshiva called Chrisos, it discusses the following issue, that a woman who gives birth has to bring a karbon, even if she has a discharge of a zava, and before she can eat the food, she brings, let's say she has to bring five karbonos. Well, she brings one, and she can eat from it, and then she still has to bring the remaining four. But she can still eat, but she's still obligated to bring the remaining four sacrifices. The problem was that the price of birds went up very much in Jerusalem. People couldn't afford that. So Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, this is Mishnah 7, chapter 1, Chrysos. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel said, I swear by this abode of the divine presence, that's the word is ma'on, he said that I swear by the Lord of Arabs, I will not lie down tonight until the price of nests will be in silver dinars, not in gold dinars. Ultimately, he entered the court and he taught a woman who has in her case five definite discharges of a zava or five definite births brings one offering, and she may then partake of the meat offerings. And the remaining offerings, that is the other four, that are not even an obligation. So he's getting rid of a Torah obligation here, and and this was a temporary emergency measure, and the price of the birds dropped a great deal. Now, how could he do this? The Bartanura says as follows. This is Bartanura on the Mishnah. He says as follows: Nichnas lebeistin afal pishehekel b'shal Torah. Even though he's being lenient in a Torah matter, the Torah says she has to bring the offerings. V'limei davar she'ino kalacha. Rav Shimon Gamliel says something that's not in accord with halacha. He could do it mishum es lasos Hashem. Because if not, then the people were poor. They wouldn't have even done. The women wouldn't have even been able to buy one bird, and then they would have b'chayev kares. They violate the isser. The point is that here you see that Rav Shimon Gamliel is able to violate the halacha. Because of Eis Lasos, because it's an emergency. And I used to think, we saw last class, the Chasam Sofer says when it comes to rabbinic prohibition, even contemporary rabbis can do that. Torah prohibition, he seems to imply not, but I have other sources that, at least I'm not convinced that contemporary rabbis would not, because of Eis Lasos, would not able to do that as well. Okay, the last thing I want to do before we move into Frankel and the dispute over Darchei Mishnah, I want to show you one final passage, and this from none other than Rav Kook, the great Rav Kook. And I want you to look at this and see if you agree with me that this is very, it sounds very much like Frankel. Which, as I said last class, I think the general approach of Frankel, not what we're going to see today, which is more controversial, but the general approach of Frankel, how Jewish law operates, that is the people, if the religious people do something, that leads to a change in many cases. Rav Kook says the same thing. And I think that this can be justified by plenty of sources. I showed you a few. I want to show you a source now, another source, where Rav Kook is simply, hold on a second. Where is it? Rav Kook is simply saying something that the historians, Yaakov Katz and the others, describe historically. He's providing a theological basis. It's in the Shmona Kvatzim. It's in Book 2, Kovetz 2, number 30. And let me just read to you what Kook says. And I have my own translation. I'll read it. But there's also a translation on Sepharia. Someone is translating the Shmona, well, you see, selected paragraphs from Yaakov David Shulman. Not all of it's translated. So here's what Rav Kook says. There are times when there is a need to transgress the Torah. Now, what does that mean, transgress the Torah? How could there ever be a time? Okay, that's what Rav Kook says. There is no one in the generation that can show the way. Because, look, there's a need to transgress the Torah. We'll see what this means. Well, look, let's say the providence wants us to be wearing regular clothes. Doesn't want us to dress any more old-fashioned. But of course, that you can't change your clothes. That would you have to. You can't just dress like the goyim. So there's a necessity for whatever God has his reasons, but we don't have a mechanism. So how did you do this? Baha inyan al yadei his partsut. The matter comes through breaching. That is the irreligious. You have, and maybe this is going further than Frankel, because, well, I shouldn't say the irreligious. No, he partsut. People start, this is the religious people. They start breaking with the practice. They start violating it. Umikomakom. Yosar tov hu olam sheyavo inyan keza al yedei shkoga. Rav Kook says it's better that this break with the practice, that is, the people stop observing, comes through a shkaga, that is, by not knowing any better, unintentionally. And this, he says, was munach hayasod. This is what we know, this principle of mutav sheyoshogin v'alyu mazidin, that the better they be unwitting than dober tzinayers. Then Rav Kook says, Raksha Navua Shruya b'Israel. Only when you had Navua in Israel, Efshar was it possible to make a Takana Inyan Kazet Al Yedei HaRasha? Could you institute, we're not talking in opposition to Halacha through emergency measure. Now, I don't know, because we just saw that Rav Shimon Gamliel didn't have Navua and he did it. But that's what Rav Kook says. I mean, when it's... there could be distinctions here between positive commandments that you don't do versus negative commandments you violate. The story of Eliyahu at Har HaCarmel, that's what I think he's referring to, actually violating negative commandments as opposed to lack of doing a positive one, perhaps. Okay, so when you have Nevuah, then you can make these decrees. Harasha, emergency measures. Va'az nasa b'derech heter mitzvah b'loy. Then you can do it in a permitted way. However, now that we don't have nevuah, ayidei stimas orin ha-nevuah, we don't have any nevuah. How can Jewish law be updated? Nasa tikun ze ayidei pirtsa. That is, the correction, the adjustment to the law happens through a break. It causes the heart to, it saddens the heart, I guess you would say. Actually, this is incorrect. This is from RPA Torah. It doesn't, the actual text is more striking. It says that it saddens the heart with the externals and it gladdens it with its inner content. What they did when they published RPA Torah, They censored it a little. So this is not the actual, this is a little bit of a, this is from the version that appears in our Pilei Tohar, I believe. Hold on a second. Hold on. I'll tell you right now. I got my my volume here. I'm very surprising. I have to tell Safaria if they, if this is the case. Because, yes, what we're looking at is the translation, the version that appears in our Pilei Torah. In the Shmona Kfatzim, it says, Shemadeves es halev mitzad chitzoni yusa. That is, when you, look on the outside, you see that people are violating halacha, that causes sadness. Umesamechas oso mitzad panim yusa. But it, gladdens those who see the inner content, namely people who can see clearly. What this is, in other words, when continued adherence to a certain halakha will have negative consequences, we don't have a mechanism to abolish halakha. We don't have a mechanism to update halakha. We don't have a Sanhedrin. Providence ensures that people begin to violate the halakha, religious people. And in time, this is then what used to be regarded as a violation. The poskim begin to accept it and they begin to be mal mitzvos, because if everyone's doing it, then you try to find some justification. This is exactly how Frankel describes Jewish law, how Yaakov Katz that, but and Rav Kook is adding here the theological element that sometimes the Hashkacha, God wants us to move in a different direction. He wants us to not to be observing, let's say, this law. How else to explain the fact that a black letter law is completely ignored? It's because the Kadosh Baruch Hu wants us, for reasons we can't understand perhaps, no longer to do it. Why is it that we don't wash anymore when we eat wet food? For whatever reason, there was a reason to go beyond this. And this happened because people started breaking the law. At least it was thought to be the law. And then it becomes accepted. Later generations can find justifications for it. So it's a striking passage in Rav Kook. It was never published by Ritzvi Yehuda. And then when it was first published, it was censored a bit. But now we have the actual text. And Rav Kook is really describing exactly the historical reality that all the historians have discussed. And he's giving a theological reason, though. Why does Jewish law work this way? Why do we see over and over again halacha? People violate it, religious people, otherwise religious people. The rabbis protest. The protests are of no use. And later generations then say, well, there must be some justification because minhag Yisraelu, and they justify it. So Rav Kook sees this as hashgacha pratis working to move us away from the halacha for whatever reason, because today we don't have a Sanhedrin, so we don't have a mechanism to update halacha, as it were. So it's striking from Rav Kook, but that's a famous passage in Israel. They call Rav Kook the Rav. Okay, now let's continue where we were. What makes Frankel so controversial, though? What we've seen so far is maybe a little edgy, a little provocative, but nothing, at least I would argue, nothing out of the fold. You'd think that he would be a good ally in the battle against the reformers. Why was he not regarded as an ally against the reformers by most? And it's because he sets forth a view of halacha, not only in the post-Talmudic period, that's what I've discussed so far, but also even in the ancient rabbinic period, that is in the days of Chazal, the way he describes it, he sees it as a developing system such that it calls into question, or at least calls into question for most people, what is traditionally understood as Torah Sheval Peh, the oral law. And let us now turn to his book, Darchei HaMishnah, because that's where matters come to a head. And this is going to be the great controversy. And I'll present the facts to you, and you can decide where you stand. And I think after this controversy, it's really hard to put Frankel in the Orthodox camp. But let's look at it. He had dealt with Jewish law before. He has a book on the Jews of Alexandria and their exegesis, and on the Septuagint. He was actually the first modern Jewish scholar to deal with the Septuagint, the Greek translation. But in 1859, his work Darchei HaMishnah appears. I have to say that it's sometimes transliterated Darkei HaMishnah with a K-E-I, just like Darkei Shalom. And I said it once, I say it again. The word is Darchei. There's no dagesh in the chaf. So it's Darchei HaMishnah. There's a lot to say about Darchei HaMishnah. It's a very important work. It really, in the history of Mishnah interpretation, non-interpretation of Mishnah like the Bar Tanura, but interpretation of what Mishnayos are, where the whole idea of the Mishnaic system, it's very important. And leaving aside the dogmatic issues we're going to get to today, the book is designed to discuss the Mishnah, how it was compiled, what principles went into it, in the compilation. When was it written down? That's a huge controversy. When was it written down? I'll get to that in a second. What principles were used to determine what goes in and what goes out? After all, you have Tosefta, what's in the Mishnah? Well, the order of it, he's interested in that also, something we've dealt with, what materials included, which people are involved in the Mishnah? How early do we have traditions included in the Mishnah? And included in the book is a section on Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai. And that's going to be the controversial section. Now, Frankel believes, just segueing for a second, that the Mishnah is already written down in the times of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. This is a very big controversy because you have two schools of thought. You have one school of thought saying it was already written down as sort of like a private private documents that not as an official. Well, I shouldn't say that. I think some hold it was actually officially written down. Frankel, he sees it more as written down, but as like private documents that people would have for themselves. And others don't see it written down until the end of the Talmudic period. This goes back to a the Rishonim argue about. This goes back to a dispute between two versions of Rav Shari Ragon. The letter of Shari Ragon, which is sent by Rav Shari Ragon to Karouan in Tunisia. We have two versions of it. One version claims that Rebbe wrote the Mishnah, and the other version says, no, that was written down. You could say Rebbe organized it, but it wasn't actually written down to the end of the Talmudic period. From Lieberman, he thought that was correct because he says, nowhere in the Gemara do you have examples where they say, well, you know, bring me the Mishnah. You don't have, on the other hand, Frankel cites proofs where you have disagreements regarding the Mishnah, but the disagreement could only have arisen if you're dealing with a written text. That is, they argue about a word, how it's spelled, let's say, and it could only be if there was a written text. On this matter, I just want to share something with you. On my post, which I just put on the story blog, I have a link to a video of Professor, my teacher, Isidore Yitzhak Torsky. That's the second one I posted. I posted an earlier one, and my last post, which I found in the University of Scranton. I took a video of him when he came in 1993, I think it was. The problem is that you can hardly hear him speaking, but it's nice to put it there to see him. The new one, which I knew nothing about. Thank Dr. Mark Herman for calling my attention to it. For some reason, it's not in the Torsky's name, is not mentioned in the description. But when Mark Herman watched the previous video, on the side, it pulled this one up. So YouTube is so smart, it knows who's in the video, even though it's not in the description. But there you see Professor Torsky. It was a whole issue on grade inflation, and you can hear his voice perfectly. You see him. And I was at Harvard at this period, and I don't even remember. I didn't know about this event. As far as I know, this is the only example, these two videos, which I posted, one of which you really can't hear, the only examples there are of videos of the late Yitzhak Isidore Torsky available. There's a short one, which I also posted, where he introduces in Yiddish Chaim Grada. But though, other than that, nothing else is out there. So if anyone who went to Harvard or knew Professor Torsky, I encourage you to go look at the video that I linked to, which is put up by Harvard not long ago. But so why do I mention this? Because I just Torsky in his book on the Riva, Rabad, he on page 133, he deals with this whole issue of the authorship of the Mishnah, why it was written, the same issue that Frankel deals with. And he points out that there's also another dispute among the Rishonim, not just when it was actually written, but why it was written. Frankel, of course, discusses this as well. But he points out that the Rambam's approach is that the reason the Mishnah was written was because of difficult times. The circumstances are so difficult. The Rambam says in the introduction to the Mishnah Torah, Talmidim mismatin, v'holchin, v'atzaros mischadshos subals, that times are so difficult that they had to publish it. They had to write, put it together. On the other hand, there's another school of thought from Rashi, also based on one of the versions of Rav Shari Ragon, and other sources that say, as reading Tversky, the Mishnah did not arise desperately from adversity, but emerged deliberately from transient good fortune. Rashi says, "V'nachu mitzara, v'shalach the kibetz kol tamid eretz yisrael." This is in Bava Basra, Bava Metzia 33b. So Rashi and others say that no, it was dafka the good times that they rested from persecution, and that's what enabled them to put this together. So Frankel deals with all these matters. He has other theories about the Mishnah. I don't want to deal with it. It's not really relevant. Although he does discuss the order of the Masachtas. This is before Geiger's view is known, and he argues that you can explain the order logically. So for Zerayim, he thought it made sense that you brachos are matters commonly observed, and you go work your way all the way to Orla, let's say. They're not so commonly observed. I tried to look through. It doesn't really work. We have to say that Geiger's explanation is the proper explanation. Okay, so what's the problem with Darchei HaMishnah? On the one hand, you could say it's a scholarly work, important, talking about the Mishnah, but it's more than that. As I said, he historicizes the oral law, and the Orthodox response is not long in coming. What do I mean by saying he historicizes the oral law? Well, obviously, everyone has to acknowledge, Frankel included, that there is an oral tradition. There's, you can't get away from it. In fact, I just saw today in the Encyclopedia Judaica, if you look on the entry dealing with the oral law, and this is not an Orthodox book, the Encyclopedia Judaica, it's a book of scholarship. It says as follows. He talks about there's a strong and close bond between the written and oral law, and you can't have one without the other. So, for example, they give examples. There's contradictions in the written law. There's not clarity. It says you'll be put to death. Well, what type of death? When it says that you should afflict your souls, like Yom Kippur, what does that mean, you should afflict your souls? There's no quantities are given for leket, shechra, peya. There's lacuna. You have reference to the laws of marriage and divorce, but you don't tell that we don't know how you're supposed to be married and divorced. It says that there's that if you flog someone, you can't have more than a fixed number of lashes. It doesn't say though which transgressions get the punishment of lashes, and it goes on and on and on examples where you see that it says if you work on the Sabbath, there's a punishment if you work. But what's the definition of work? And you tell someone who doesn't know that much about Torah, you say that. You know, you could carry big items, heavy items around your house or around the neighborhood and area. That's not working. But if you go out to your garden and then plant a little flower there, that's working. People won't get it. And that's because the word work for malacha is not really the best translation. It's the best we have. But so everyone agrees there has to be some oral law. But what do we mean by an oral law? How much of an oral law? And what does the oral law encompass? That is, it's one thing to say, well, there have to be traditions going back. So if you say that if you work on the Sabbath, you have to know what work is. But what about every page of the Gemara? What about drushas? What about halacha Moshe Mitzrayim, as we'll see? And I think the best way to see this, to see the controversy and the problems that Frankel's position created, is to begin with the attack from the Orthodox on him, because the attack points out the very passages that we'll see. From these passages, we'll see what the problem is from the Orthodox perspective. And also, these are the passages that show us Frankel's position. And fortunately, we can see this very well in the collected writings of Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, Volume 5. Because this volume is devoted, it's called The Origin of the Oral Law, and it has many of Hirsch's articles dealing with it. And then in part two, for over 100 pages, it's devoted to Frankel's Darchei HaMishnah. Here, too, they write Darchei HaMishnah. It's Darchei HaMishnah. And it begins, Hirsch used to have a journal, and it begins with an article by a rabbi, Gottlieb Fischer, a Hungarian rabbi. He was a Baal Bos, but he had smicha. He was a student of the Chosam Sofer. He didn't serve as a rabbi of a community, but in those days, you had lots of people who were great Talmidei Chachamim who didn't serve as rabbis of community. And he wrote an article in Hirsch's journal, and here they translate it as an epistle by Rav Gottlieb Fischer to all friends of truth and of our Jewish future. I can't remember. This begins. What happened? He wrote it in Hebrew, and Hirsch, I'm reading it here, Hirsch translated it into German. Okay, so what does he say? Well, I just want to begin on page 213. Right at the beginning, Fischer says that he says, I wouldn't go after Frankel if Frankel was a reformer. If Frankel was like the people that we know from the rabbinic conferences of Brunswick, Frankfurt, and Breslau, if he was a reformer, I would have remained silent. However, he says that since the author he says, delights in deceptive appearances, since he wraps himself in the cloak of a true believer in tradition. And we know that he's a completely observant. He says he speaks with great respect of the Sofrim, the Anshei Knesset Zagol, and the Tanaim, and yet his views are completely apart from them. So that's why Fischer has to expose Frankel, because Frankel, on the outside, seems like he's not just an observant Jew, that there's no doubt. He seems like he's an Orthodox Jew, and many people have assumed that he's a, quote, Orthodox Jew, and therefore what Fischer is going to show is that from his writings, he can't be placed in our camp. And he says that Frankel is a star among our scholarly contemporaries, therefore, and he's the principal of rabbinical seminary, and therefore we need to expose that what he says is full of fallacies that will lead the minds of our contemporaries astray from the Torah, that is, away from the dogmas. He says, quote, any honest critic will have to admit that no matter how hard Frankel tries to exalt the sages who have handed down the oral law, his principles are in sharp contrast to their teachings. Though he voices disapproval and contempt when referring to the Sadducees who reject the oral tradition, he basically sides with them and subscribes completely to their principles. So Frankel is a Sadducee. Now, what do you mean Frankel's a Sadducee? Frankel's a Sadducee. Well, how could Frankel be a Sadducee when all he does is talk about how great the oral tradition is and is a complete observer of halakha? Because the Sadducees denied the oral law. They denied the Mosaic origin of the oral law. So what Fischer is saying is that Frankel, despite the fact his practices, he denies the Mosaic origin of the oral law. Frankel, so in that sense, he agrees with the Pharisees. Now, Frankel, as Fischer says, is going to attribute the oral law to the Anshei Knesset Hagdolah. So obviously the Sadducees didn't do that. They didn't accept the oral law at all. But the fundamental point is that Frankel does not attribute it to a Mosaic origin, rather later. Well, is that true? Is that what Frankel says? That's what we're going to have to examine now. In fact, after this strong introduction, Fischer says, well, let's see what our author says about the meaning of what the mitzvahs are, Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai, and the 13 hermeneutical principles. So traditionally, we have this notion of Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai, that there are laws that are not in the Torah, but are thought to come down from Sinai, and also the hermeneutical principles. So you have Gezeirah Shavah. What is Gezeirah Shavah? Is Gezeirah Shavah just something that the rabbis make up, or is that something that... Now, all these matters are going to be more complicated than Fischer, and less complicated, I would think, than Frankel. I think we'll be able to find even a middle ground. But let's start with the, and we're going to have the maximalist position and a minimalist position. But let's start with the Fischer maximalist position, that the 13 Midos, that the Torah, that these come from Sinai, and Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai, I mean, we're going to see it's not so clear, even with Gezeirah Shavah, because often what's a Gezeirah Shavah is not really a Gezeirah Shavah, but I'll give you some examples of that. And he says, he begins by quoting Frankel. In the introduction to the Darchei HaMishnah, Frankel says that the interpretations of the Anshei Knesset Hagdolah, and who are also the Sofrim, that their works of interpretation are great and complex. It requires painstaking research, et cetera, by this work, the laws were interpreted, both theory and practice. In other words, Frankel says that the Anshei Knesset Hagdolah were the first ones that they started interpreting the law, and then, of course, the law continues to be interpreted. And he says, this is the oral tradition. This is the oral law. Vahu ikar Torah Shebaal Peh. So what's the Torah Shebaal Peh? He tells us the interpretations of the halachot and the law by the men of the Great Assembly, Anshei Knesset Hagdolah, who are also known as the Sofrim, because these men interpreted the law and appended their interpretations to the scriptural text. This is the oral Torah. Well, okay, if that's the Oral Torah, then what's going on here, Frankel? Isn't the Oral Torah supposed to go back to Sinai? And you're saying that the Oral Torah is something we can identify with the interpretations of the sages. In one sense, we refer to the whole Gemara as the Oral Torah, but that's not what Frankel's talking about. Frankel does not say in the introduction that in describing the Mishnah, he doesn't say, for instance, that there are traditions that go back to Sinai, and they're recorded in the Mishnah, and where there's disputes, the disputes are recorded, and then the Talmud is... No, no. He begins. He mentions Torah, but then he moves on to Anshei Knesset Hagdola, and obviously that would continue with the into the Tanaitic era, and he says that this is the oral law. Well, Fisher says this is in contradiction to the Rambam. The Rambam says in the introduction to the Mishnah Torah, quote, all the laws were given to Moshe and Har Sinai together with their explanations. It says, "Call mitzvah shenitnu lo Moshe b'Sinai b'feirush." They were given with their explanations, and it cites the Gemara, the Rambam, that I've given you the tablets, the teaching and the commandment, Torah v'mitzvah. What is that? Torah, that's Torah shebichsav, mitzvah zo perusha. And then the Rambam says that we're obligated with tzivanu lasos Torah al pi mitzvah o mitzvah zoi and nikreis Torah shebalpeh. So we see that the Rambam holds, and it's explicit in the Rambam, that Torah Sheba'al Peh, that is the explanation of the commandments, goes back to Sinai. And yet Frankel, in Darchei Mishnah, he doesn't say that. He describes the explanations as originating with the Anshei Knesset Hagdola, and that's what the Torah Sheba'al Peh is. He says that the interpretations of the Torah Sheba'al Peh were not the products of any individual man. Rather, they were the product of all the sages coming together who studied the Torah and came up with understandings of what the psukim mean. So on the one hand, you could say that's great. You're looking, the Anshei Knesset Hagdola, you're putting him on a pedestal. But on the other hand, Fisher says, what happened to the Torah Sheba'al Peh going back to Moshe? I see it's already 9:28, so we're going to have to stop here. Next class, we're going to get into great detail. Fisher's criticism, Frankel's response, what Hirsch has to say, what Shlomo Yehuda Rappaport has to say, and then something amazing from Frankel, where had he said it at the beginning, maybe there wouldn't have been need for all this controversy. Because wait till you hear what Frankel says at the beginning, at the end of all this. But and next class, we're going to get into this idea of Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai and Frankel's proof from the Rush that his position is a traditional position. Okay, let me take the questions and comments. We'll definitely have a few more classes dealing with Frankel. And then I'm thinking, as a couple of you asked, I think before moving into the next thing, if Rabbi Kelman thinks it's a good idea, I think he does, maybe a class or two on the letters of the Rav I published. I've received letters emails from a number of you about these letters in Hakira, so I can explain about these letters of Rav Soloveitchik. And then I want to do Mordechai Kaplan. But maybe we'll do first do the Hirsch-Bamberger dispute, and then we'll do Kaplan. We should cover everything. Someone privately asked, did I see a review of the book of The Golem of Montreal on Udo Rosenberg? Yes, I saw that. I have the book by Ira Robinson. Thomas said, on bicycles, or really rickshaws, there's a permissive response by the Ben Ish Chai. Yes, the Ben Ish Chai permitted it. I don't know why you say rickshaw. He mentions bicycles. I believe, doesn't he? He does. It's to Bombay, and I thought he says it's in the Rav Pa'alim. I forget now. I think he mentions explicitly bicycles in the tshuva, and that was the tradition. That was the Iraqi tradition as well. I'll check later. He mentions bicycles. He's referring to bicycles in the Rav Pa'alim. Rickshaw is when someone pulls you. That was also an issue. They also did that in India. That was based upon Heterim. But I don't remember if that's based on the Ben Ish Chai. If you can check it, let me know. Yes, so someone privately points out that when you have a Sanhedrin, any drushas we can change. I mentioned that already. You can change. I gave you the example of women as witnesses. So you can change it. You can find another drasha. In my forthcoming book on Rav Kook, Rav Kook deals with this at great length. He says that you can use drashot. So yes, you can have 22 malachot. You can do you can do everything. What is Eric says, what's the dominant modern academic viewpoint about when the Mishnah was actually written down? I don't know, actually. I don't know if there's, we have some people listening to the classes who know more about this than I do. I don't know if there's a dominant a viewpoint that is the standard approach right now. Marty says, how do you determine how great a Sanhedrin is or a posek? Isn't there an idea in the greatness of the rabbis declined in every generation? No, when it says, Godo b'chachma u'b'minyan. Well, b'minyan, we saw the Rambam that it has to do with students. B'chachma, it's a good question. It has to be great. I think generally we assume that it has to be a general assumption that they're greater. If the rabbis decline in each generation, that's a way to ensure that you can never overrule them because the generations decline. But in the matter we're speaking about now, about drashot, or a gezeira, which wasn't accepted, you don't need to be greater. I'll see if I have other interpretations of that for next class, though. Okay, when Eric says, when were the men of the Great Assembly supposed to have lived and done their interpretations? That's the great mystery, the men of the Great Assembly, which we don't know. We don't know much about. I mean, so Rambam includes Ezra, right, among the Anshei Knesset HaGedola. It's hard to know, and it's really hard to know. Is it 300 BCE? Is it earlier? It's very mysterious. Is Ezra really part of the Anshei Knesset HaGedola? Sometimes he's described as sort of being the beginning of it. So now someone privately sends me a link to chainless bicycles from the 19th century. So I'll take a look at that later. But it raises the question about the Ben Ish Chai, what type of bicycle the Ben Ish Chai in the 20th century was dealing with. It could be that the Ben Ish Chai, it's completely separate. The issue of the Ben Ish Chai is you're making a gezeira. The Ben Ish Chai held that it's permissible, and the opponents said, well, you can't. They extend the gezeira. Just like you can't ride a horse, let's say, on Shabbos, because you might pull a branch. Therefore, you can't ride a bicycle because what it might lead to. So people challenge that, defenders of the Ben Ish Chai's position. Well, how can you make a new gezeira? And the answer is that it's not, as C. Pastor Frank said, it's not a new gezeira. What we're doing is simply extending. A horse is a means of travel. A bicycle is a means of travel. So it's all in the same genre. So we're not making a new gezeira. We're just extending the original gezeira. Others said, gave other reasons not to ride a bicycle, Shabbos spirit. But again, Shabbos spirit, it's hard to know what the Shabbos spirit is. So it could change in different eras. But it's hard to imagine that bicycles could, when we haven't ridden bicycles for 100 years, and it's the unanimous Ashkenazic minhag not to, and it's even falling by the wayside among the Sephardim. The people you see riding bicycles, are they the ones Frankel would say are the religious Jews? Are these the kids with the black hats that I see riding the scooters? When you see guys who look very firm riding bicycles, then we can have the conversation again. Maybe then the practice will change, but I don't see it happening. Okay, Rabbi Kelman.
Okay, thank you. So I think it's generally assumed Ezra is the founder of Anshei Knesset HaGedola. I think that's the way it's generally assumed. But anyways, and probably Bechokma, so I'm holding here, Kellner's book, Menachem Kellner on my mind, and he's in the Kleinim generation, where he claims the Rambam doesn't accept the idea that the generations are becoming less. We know in knowledge we're becoming more. I mean, obviously we advance, science advances, knowledge advances, but everybody agrees with halakha kibatrai. Everybody agrees to halakha is like the later sage because, the midget on the shoulders of the giant. So even if we want to say we're lesser, I assume b'chokma would mean we have more knowledge, not necessarily that we're greater. but we've accumulated more knowledge. So that's why you could say, because otherwise the whole thing makes no sense, because then you'd never have a Beit Din that could overturn the ruling of a Beit Din.
Oh, okay. I'm going to look into this. It's really interesting. It's an interesting question. Now, you mentioned Ezra, but they also say Zechariah was a, you know, you have passages talking about the later Nevi'im, Zechariah.
Right. Zechariah, Malachi. Right. Malachi.
Yeah, we're also in the Anshei Knesset Sagdola. So it's really hard to know. And I have to tell you that there are those who, I mean, some cynical, critical academic scholars who don't believe in the whole thing about Jacob's Sodoma. They think that this is just a later creation. Frankel doesn't say this, but they think that at best you had earlier sages, but the idea that you had an organized court, an organized thing, they see that as a fiction. That's what some skeptical academic scholars will say. Yeah.
Okay, I don't know. Listen.
And finally, Jacob says, the people I see riding bicycles on Shabbos are the ones watching our classes. Only the ones, I think, from the Syrian community, I hope, at least. Okay, thank you.
Halacha is very broad. What can we say? Very different approaches within the halachic system. Yeah. I mean, it is hard to really know why bicycles should be usur, but that's for another time. But anyways. Okay. Thank you. Please, God, we'll see you next week. Happy Thanksgiving for American Thanksgiving for all the Americans here, and enjoy your time in Florida. And please, God, we'll see you next Monday. And tomorrow, continue our regular schedule. Yeah. You want to say something?
No. Well, yeah. Let's say we built a bicycle that's like a tricycle. I mean, technically, it would be permissible. So would the rabbis permit it? It's like that umbrella. David Eisen sent me the Shabbos umbrella. We have this umbrella that doesn't close all the way, so it's always a little bit open. And a lot of big rabbanim in Israel, including Rav Nevensol, as I recall, gave permission for it on Shabbos. I'll tell you next class, the Shabbos umbrella. But you can imagine we could create, if a scooter is okay on Shabbos, why can't you make a bike like a scooter? Like where there's no chains, right. There's no nothing?
Yeah, but this idea that because it may break, that's an invented reason. There's no reason in halacha to...
Well, you might fix it.
But that's true about anything. In other words, why make that zero on a bicycle? We don't make new zero. I mean, it might... How often does a bicycle break? You know, I understand that's what people say, but I don't know that one has to say that. There's no halachic necessity to say, because a bike has a chain, you can't ride it. That's like an...
Well, you could say a baby carriage could also break. So that's why they say there's a chain. But you're right. They're making this up as, you know, they're trying to find reasons to...
Right. I understand they don't want to allow bicycles. Fine, whatever. But it could have easily gone the other way. In other words, there's no...
So what are you saying? Shabbos skirt is the real reason why...
Yeah, I would assume so. I would assume new with transportation. Yeah, I don't... Right, whatever it is.
But a scooter is of the dechol. That's the problem. That's the rabbi, right. The mamar.
Well, it's like everything. Like, and is playing basketball of the dechol. I mean, you know, that's all these...
Yeah.
It's a little bit subjective. I think in South Africa, people would play sports. The Frum community play sports on Shabbos. I think that was just accepted. It's part of the minucha. You know, I believe in what the early Eda journal, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, Berman, Saul Berman.
There's a whole article on playing sports on Shabbat. Yeah. Different societies define what is keeping with the Shabbat spirit differently, and they can change over time. Yeah. Anyways, no, it'd be interesting if bikes would listen. I remember when I was around there, someone in shul, he stopped driving his car and he rode his bicycle. I thought, great. The choice was his car or his bike. So obviously there's no question what you tell the person to do. But anyways. Yeah. Okay. We'll see you next week. Thank you.
Until next week.
Okay. Tomorrow, Nava Finkelman at 11, Rabbi Shulman at 1, and everybody have a wonderful day, wonderful week. And hope to see you soon. And please invite a friend. Thank you very much. Lila Tov. You have the Hoda on Hoda. Yeah. Yeah. Turkey Hoda, you know, and Chag Hoda. Okay.
Sameh.
The regular day here, regular work day in Canada, Thursday, Friday, but okay.